Well, welcome back, everyone. Today I want to talk first about kind of a general overview, like how to read Eigen. Marianne came in and said, it's complex, and it is. And another person told me, hey, this isn't linear, and that's also true. He's not. I want to compare Eigen to some Eastern lineages where there is a meditative ritual performed by walking around or circumambulating like a holy shrine or a stupa while praying or meditating or reciting mantras, circling around as one form of encompassing. Another metaphor for Eigen's writing might be the kaleidoscope, which also circles around. You know, you look in a kaleidoscope, there's bits of colored glass creating new images and patterns with each time you turn it a little bit. Eigen seems to practice something analogous in his writing and the way he structures his books. You'll begin to notice multifaceted ways that he highlights things by his descriptions, as he turns things this way and that. So this is another form of circumambulating. For instance, in speaking of the phrase, the wordless depths in the introduction, Eigen tries to depict how such a thing as wordless depths is so important in different aspects of life. He says it's important in art, in problem solving, ethical feeling, spiritual experience, emotional contact, and psychic processing. It's also seen, this kaleidoscopic way of encompassing is also seen when he writes, it is awesome to be a living being who feels, cries, laughs, sings, dies, who hurts others and is hurt, who goes mad, becomes inspired, or is just happy to be alive to each day to the extent one can. Life never ceases being an unpredictable sea, raising up, dashing down, pressing us through ranges of emotion, now more alive, threatened, empty, deadened, eager. What a range. So one of the things I hope in our little circle here, in our room, full of diverse personalities and histories, we can also be a kind of a kaleidoscope for each other, to each other, offering whatever you feel is important or what moves you when you read this material. So please feel free to add your own vision, your own emotional response, your own thought, your own color and pattern, refracted through the particular light that you bring. Eigen presses us through a range of emotions. And ranges of emotion are Eigen's home turf, a place from which he lives. Much of psychology in the clinical and interpersonal sense revolves around emotional experience or its lack. Our feeling life, our sensory life, what these give us, what these add, as well as how they disrupt and how they traumatize. Notice, as I speak, I'm trying to include both sides, both valences, positive and negative, which is a doubleness. And with our chapter title, we have another double, distinction union, hyphenated, or union distinction. And for the first part of my introductory comments today, I'm going to be being a little bit more conceptual. During the second part, I'm going to talk about Eigen's patient, Abe, and relate to that more experientially. But first, I want to go to the upstairs thinking and conceptual stuff and talk about distinction union. It's a key notion, not just because it's a form of doubleness, but there is an interwovenness. Perhaps most fundamental to our psychological development in thinking of distinction union is mind-body, mind and body, which I'll get to in a moment. The other one is self and other. Let's start with self and other. On the one hand, each of us, we're each alone, distinct, separate beings, individuals. At the same time, we are also inextricably interwoven and connected with one another. We are permeable to each other, yet distinct, connected, yet separate. Whether in our absolute dependency on caretakers as infants, or our ongoing interdependency as social beings throughout life. Our first significant other was our mothering one. Infant and mothering one together in a primary preoccupation with one another, to use Winnicott's term. In each other's orbit, separate yet together. And Eigen in this first chapter gives many conceptual examples of distinction union. For instance, the Holy Trinity of Christianity, a three in one, or our sense of time, past, present, future, as three in one, Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita being a manifestation of many possibilities, or even the physicist David Bohm with his use of the explicate and implicate orders. In psychoanalytic thought, Melanie Klein, Wilfred Bion, and others wrote about fusion and splitting tendencies, together and separateness. One could extend this further and speak of primal emotional fears, like too much closeness or union as intrusive, sometimes felt as suffocating. On the other side, too much distance or separation can feel like abandonment or emotional starvation. These, of course, are extremes, starvation and suffocation. But there's also much nourishment and joy in being separate and together. There's the joy of solitude and the ecstasy of merging with another person. Each of us is unique. And here's another distinction union. As a human group, we are all both the same and different simultaneously. Each of us is unique. We're unique in our personality, our temperament, our background, our genetics. But at the same time, we all generally have the same basic physical structure. Two eyes, one heart, same number of bones, organs. So to say we're all the same and we're all different is a paradoxical way of thinking that involves doubleness or two-ness in relation. Doubleness and two-ness in all their many kinds of relatedness. And I'm speaking of something here beyond rigid binaries. These are more like relational binaries, opposites or complements, because they can vary in how many different ways they react to each other. I'm tempted to pull up the board right now and explain that. But let me just go on for a little bit more. Reversals. We talked about reversals last time. Reversals also contain two-ness, going from one side to another, one place or feeling to another. With people who have a bipolar disorder or characterological issues, one moment they might love and idealize, the next moment one becomes lower than low. Another way of thinking about distinction union is our own self-relationship, our self-reflective consciousness. We can take ourselves as objects of thought, and we can even relive feelings. This capacity allows us to be somewhat separate and distinct from ourself, gain perspective, while at the same time we're in union with self. In this way, we're able to chew on things, turn them this way and that, change perspective, or even entertain multiple perspectives. And when you think about it, it's pretty amazing capacity that our minds can do this. Reverse things, take multiple perspectives. You remember the, let me just get the board and take that up. Sorry. I want to talk about distinction union in another way. Sorry, Jason, I'm right up here. I want to artificially divide reality into two parts. On the left side, experiential reality. On the right side, physical reality. Experiential reality, what do I mean? There's a lot of synonyms we could use. We could talk about spirit, psyche, mind. Physical reality is something solid, tangible, matter, material. You know, we talk about, you know, spirit and matter is an old division of the world. Psyche and soma, psychosomatic, psyche and soma, mind and body. I'm artificially dividing these up to talk about them because they're always interconnected. They're always part of each other. Experiential reality, what's the difference here? There's a lot of them. Each of you is having an experiential reality right now, inside yourself. I can't tell what it is. It's private. It's yours alone. It's invisible. It's not measurable. It's boundless. And we could even say that it's infinite. Imagination is infinite. It can take us many places. It is not bounded. On the other side, physical reality is. Physical reality is measurable. It's palpable. It's visible. It's bounded. And it's finite. Not that it doesn't change and evolve and develop and move, but it's not the same as experiential reality. Now, why is this an arbitrary division? Because it helps me explain some things I want to explain, which is there are a lot of folks in the world, mostly hardcore materialists, who believe there's only one thing that exists in the world, atoms and molecules and chemicals. And they would deny that this is a real domain of its own, the left side, experiential reality. Why? Because, true enough, our experiential reality has to be based on our neurology, our physicality. Some people believe that's not even true, that spirit is out there in the world. It's incorporeal. Spirit exists independent of physical reality. But I like this division just because it's sort of an elegant way to get at distinction union. Now, Eigen takes it a step further. He says not only are they interwoven, not only are they interconnected, but that there's some of each within the other. That they can be part of each other. Well, we know this from just living our lives. But what would that mean? Can we think in terms of inspirited flesh or enfleshed spirit? That's kind of a Zen koan, to think in terms of that doubleness. To take those two and conjoin them or even merge them together. So you might call me a dyed-in-the-wool dualist, but it's not a rigid dualism. These are not rigid binaries. I want to show how many ways they relate to each other. And one kind of a thought experiment I like is when I meet a hard and fast scientist type who believes, no, there's only one thing in the world, which is physical reality, and that we are just, human beings are just sophisticated machines, you know, that our neurology has developed to the point where we can actually reflect on ourselves and do all that stuff. What I like to say is, the only way we know about physical reality and measure it is through using our experiential selves. They might want to say that, no, it's really the brain looking at the brain. But I like this other way of thinking about it. Psyche, mind, imagination. I also feel that because we have these two different aspects to our being, that they play off one another. There's a tension between them too. They can nourish each other. They can promote growth in each. There's been some recent research that Holocaust survivors, their offspring have markers of trauma in their DNA. So there's an example, or the research that shows that psychotherapy causes significant changes in brain structure function. So Eigen's work is a lot about doubleness and interconnectedness and fusions, but not only. There's many ways that his doubleness combine and separate. If we separate these two, we can speak of mind in terms of experience. Our experience in each now moment. And for body, of course, we speak of physical processes, neural synapses firing, blood circulating, respirating. But neither one of these are more true or real than the other. They're categorically different, yet interconnected. Nor can either be reduced to the other. You know, there's Hindu religious folks who want to take the mind and make that superior to the physical reality of the body. They believe that we make up our own reality. Some of Deepak Chopra's work addresses this. But I say they're both co-equal, and they both matter. It's as though they each have inalienable rights and realities, yet they're always together. They're always intimate, interconnected partners. We could think of another way to approach distinction union. Think of characterological patients who tend to split reality into all good and all bad. Black and white thinking. Either or. Extremes. And then let's take the other side. People that gravitate toward union and oneness and inclusiveness. Both have value, and both can be used, I would say, poorly. Okay, so let me explain what that means. In the sciences, separating, discriminating, differentiating, isolating has great value. But for people with black and white, all or nothing thinking, they get into trouble emotionally. Let's take the other side, union or oneness or inclusiveness. It can be a beautiful thing. We are all one species, even though we have all this diversity among us. But what happens when the quest for oneness or wholeness or purity becomes exaggerated and exclusive? Then we get into ideologies that believe they're the only one. And then we go to war. So a desire for absolute totality, when it becomes extreme, can become totalitarian. It risks becoming an unchanging closed system. And to break things up into parts can be useful, but it depends how we do it. How about to be totally merged and in union and undifferentiated? Is that possible? Eigen feels that anything that exists must in some way also be a little bit differentiated. How else could it be noted or addressed or engaged? For example, even the most evolved yogi who merges with divinity or achieves a samadhi of oneness, how would they mark such an experience? By their own absence? Like when we say, I must have been asleep because I can't remember being awake? In other words, if a self with no object or reference point outside it was possible, it would simply vanish, wouldn't it? If there was no reference point or object outside it or reflection. So on the distinction side, that to be only separate is not possible either. We're dependent. We're interdependent beings. We depend on others even when we don't know it. Every time you get in your car and go somewhere, you are depending on other people to drive well and not hit you. Let alone how we started out in life with primary dependence. So we're both. We're both distinct and we're in union. So neither pure merger or union nor pure separateness or distinction characterize our lived experience. We are always both. And then all the ways that these two things can enter into different kinds of relationships with each other. They can be antagonistic, symbiotic, parasitic, nullifying, disconnecting, nourishing. There are many kinds of relationships, and this is where Eigen gets a bit dizzying. We can always ask what one or the other of these tendencies is doing at any moment, since both are always co-present. They implicitly characterize mind-body as well as self-other relations and can be read on many different planes, including adaptive planes, psychic, behavioral, individual, sociological, and mystical. So this is a mystery. Why are we a doubleness? Even a paradox to ourselves. To be permeable and distinct, connected and separate, in union yet distinct, is part of our plasticity and persistence, part of the mystery and difficulty and creative challenge of our nature. Eigen asks if we can make room for ourselves, and what quality of partnership with our beings can we work out? I think I'll stop there for a minute before I have another section where I talk about the patient Abe and dig into the chapter a little more, but I think I want to stop at this point and ask you what your reactions were or how you felt about what you read or anything at all. Any comments? Now I'd like to try and apply distinction union to what happened between Eigen and his patient Abe in this chapter. After our last group meeting, a couple of you were interested in Eigen's notion of boundless unknown support. Boundless unknown support. Where does it come from? What is it? Eigen and Winnicott both speak about an aloneness supported by another that one does not know is there. And you can read a little about this on page 10 in our chapter. But there's another book I'd like to read from that fleshes it out a little bit more. And this is from Faith and Transformation, where Eigen gave lectures in Seoul, South Korea, during a seminar several years ago. And he references Winnicott and what it's like at the beginning of life in terms of dependency of the baby on the mother or the mothering one. And Winnicott says that there is a dependency the baby has that it doesn't know it has. And it's a dependency we may not know we have. But if there is not support for this dependency early on, our whole existence is threatened and may be damaged. So Winnicott writes of an essential aloneness. And that's a strong term. And I'm reading now from Faith and Transformation on page 19 at the bottom. He feels that we are essentially alone. And it may be strange to hear Winnicott say this, since Winnicott is so involved with relationship. Yet he says that at the moment, the most intimate moment of relationship, we are essentially alone. And he says the baby is supported in an alone state by a not quite cognized presence. So the aloneness we are touching here precedes a clear self-other awareness. The mother is there helping the baby, but the baby may not take in the fact that another being distinct from him or her is keeping them in life. And among the passages in which Winnicott feels pressed to convey a paradox is the following. And this is Winnicott. Quote, at the start is an essential aloneness. At the same time, this aloneness can only take place under maximum conditions of dependence. End quote. And that's a paradox for Winnicott. It's an essential paradox. The essential aloneness we feel inside ourselves, the quality of our aloneness, depends upon the quality of support we have gotten. And this plays a role in the quality of support we can now give ourselves. The quality of aloneness depends in part on the quality of support we give it. And this carries over to the present moment. Winnicott is pointing to a very important experience. Eigen says that a great psychic reality is at stake, a precious part of our beings we must make time for and take the time to live and to sense, an aloneness supported by another one doesn't know is there. A primary aloneness supported by what Eigen calls an unknown boundless other. Quote, a sense of unknown boundless support. Aloneness has in its very core a sense of an unknown infinite other. No wonder Winnicott says so much depends on the quality of environmental response. The very quality of our aloneness depends on it. A primary aloneness supported by an unknown boundless other. If you penetrate to the core of your aloneness, you will find not only yourself, there will also be this unknown boundless presence. Is it you? Is it other than you? What is it? An unknown boundless presence at the very core of your aloneness. No matter how deep you go, you will find it there. So here we have another way to think about distinction union. What happened with Eigen and his patient Abe? What was it about their unconscious contact, their being together in the room over a long period of time, years, that helped Abe? And it was quite a process, and a scary one, a frightening one for Eigen. Because as we read, he was at the beginning of his career, and he was unfamiliar with the journey that he and Abe started to go on. And yet, even though Eigen started out kind of being like a Greek chorus, where he would cheer Abe on when he was doing well and help support and pick him up when he fell down and relapsed, still, neither of them really knew what was happening. Yet they were together. Abe didn't miss a session, kept coming, except when he was out of it. And there was something without words that was happening. They were two distinct, separate human beings doing therapy together, and yet a kind of a merger, an interconnection, a permeability was present through which other communication channels started to take root. Eigen speaks of it this way in another book. He says, quote, "I have become convinced that much of what happens in therapy, often what is most important, is nonverbal, permanently outside the reach of words. But this in no way minimizes the use of words. There are some people who must storm the gates with words and try to say everything, and sometimes they take words or words take them over the edge, opening new paths of experience. But in most therapeutic work, there is a tone or an atmosphere or a feel in the room that is more important. Words, after all, do not merely involve the exchange of information. They are part of the exchange of states of being. There is an osmotic aspect to therapy that must not be overlooked. People are sensitive and feel each other's impacts, but often we do not know what to do with them. A therapist is a kind of specialist in letting the other in, feeling the impact of the other, staying with images and thoughts to which the feel of the other gives rise. A patient not only senses the therapist, but senses how he affects the therapist. What does a therapist do with this impact? To what extent can he let it build? Where will it take him? The patient, in a way, reads himself in the therapist's being and vice versa. There are unspoken dramas in every human interaction. Is there room for me in another's feeling life? To what extent must I short-circuit myself in order to communicate at all? Where do our feeling exchanges start? How far can they go? All of these factors were at play between Eigen and his patient, Abe, and something came through. In fact, because enough trust and faith evolved between the two of them over time, permeability increased. And Eigen writes that one thing permeability can do is absorb good feeling over time. Eigen's quiet attitude and willingness to wait, not be intrusive, had something to do with it. He was more of a positive background and foreground presence. He was, as he says, generally a milder traumatic presence than Abe's parents. So that invisible good feeling in the background helped. Even when Abe was most contracted and isolated and alone and nonverbal, it appears he had something of Eigen with him, inside of him. And at some point, a reversal happened, and Abe discovered a radiant eye kernel, a radiant point of self that then began to expand out of its contracted state. One can think of this many ways, comma. Common parlance might call it even miraculous. And this brings us back to unconscious to unconscious communication and the mystery of all that we do not know that goes on between human beings in a therapy process and elsewhere. It's one of the beautiful things about Eigen's work that he does not foreclose on the mystery with answers and solutions, but instead, he would like us to somehow be open and permeable ourselves to new fields of experiencing.